Okay, let's begin.
Oh, she was in Shillishaw? Mm-hmm.
Tammy was in Shillishaw.
Cool. Okay, let's begin. We're going to jump right in. We are in Perek Gimel.
Malachim Bet.
Malachim Bet? No, Shmuel Bet.
I mean Shmuel Bet.
One day we'll, please God, we'll get to Malachim Bet. But we are a little ways off.
We have to go through a lot of pain and suffering before we get to that.
Oh, yeah. Last week we dealt with the introduction in Perek Bet, which is the list of all of David's sons, wives and sons, if you will. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the significance of identifying each wife via the son, who is only one child, but essentially the firstborn from each of them, and the significance of them. We even talked a little bit about the chronology of some of them. Mishneu Kila'av, Lavigail, Eshet Nevala Karmeli.
Yeah. Can we do the learning? It's my Bubby's yard site, so it should be Lezecher Nishma Sarah Hannah Bat Aryeh Leib, Sarah Hannah.
Sarah Hannah.
Sorry.
Not a problem. Thank you. Appreciate that. I forgot. So we talked a little bit about Kila'av at the end, Avigail, Eshet Nevala Karmeli, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And where Kila'av fits in and why everybody else in this list is kind of vying for, struggling for success to the throne, or an heir to the throne of David. But of Kila'av we don't know anything else. We saw various issues, and one of the suggestions that somehow Kila'av is connected to Nevala Karmeli, although Chazal reject that interpretation, but I think Rav Medan actually thinks it makes the most sense, given the fact that Kila'av never appears in any story subsequently, and certainly he's not trying to become the next king. He's never in line. He's never struggled. He's not part of the conflict between Avshalom and Daniel and Amnon. And so that suggestion actually makes a lot of sense, especially considering Kila'av l'Avigail Eshet Nevala Karmeli. We talked about Amnon, Achinom Israelit, and where Achinom Israelit fits in, the fact that she is the first wife that David marries after he leaves Michal. Kila'av is the story of Nevala Karmeli. Avshalom ben Ma'acha bat Talmai Melech Geshur. I think we mentioned also this mystery of Chazal's understanding of Ma'acha, that Ma'acha was an Eshet Yifator that David took in the midst of a battle. But the battle seems to be with Geshur, although there's two references to Geshur in Tanakh. One is in the north in the Golan Heights, Geshuriva Ma'achati, which makes sense in the names, Ben Ma'acha, Geshur, Geshuriv Ma'achati, and the other is a reference to Geshur near Eretz Plishtim. But the war, a major battle, Eshet Yifator style captives, etc., is a war that appears in Perek Yud, which is sort of like this world war in the context of Tanakh, where David fights all of his allies against all of the allies of the north, and in that battle, Chazal identify him having taken this Ma'acha as a Eshet Yifator. Raise the question for us, the sequence of events here, because that battle hasn't taken place yet. So, and it doesn't take place until after he's in Yerushalayim. So the suggestion that these are sons all born to him in Hebron is complicated, because that battle is later on, nonetheless. Then we have Adoniah ben Chagit. Adoniah will play a role in the beginning of Malachim Aleph when he tries to usurp the throne from Shlomo, or before Shlomo gets to sit on it. V'chamshi Shvatya ben Avital. We talked about Shvatya ben Avital as the lineage of the continuation of the house of David through Hillel HaZakeh and after the Churban by a Cheni period. And finally, brings us to Ashishi, Yitra'am le'Eglat Eshet David. Yitra'am le'Eglat Eshet David. Eglat Eshet David, again, we don't know who this is. Chazal suggest, ironically, that this is a reference to Michal. Why is it a reference to Michal? So Chazal lists I think we didn't do this on Monday, correct?
No.
Yishu Michal. I did it on Wednesday. Chazal actually list or address a question with regards to Michal. So just a quick refresher, who is Michal?
She's the son of Shaul.
The son of Shaul, David's first wife, who after David ran away, Shaul had taken and sort of retroactively annulled the marriage and gave her to Palti ben Laish. We'll talk about that not this week, but next week. And David at some point or another gets her back. It's actually in this parak that we're going to study today that David gets Palti ben Laish to gets Michal back from Palti ben Laish, and so Michal returns to her, to him. And Michal, for all intents and purposes, was his first wife and is ostensibly his primary wife. Very early in the story in Shmuel Bet, in Perek Vav, if you take a quick glance, David, in his effort to bring the Aron and the Mizbeach back together, famously brings the Aron out of its hiding place in Kiryat Yarim and restores it to Yerushalayim.
And there was a big party.
There was a big, well, there was a couple of things that happened. There was a series of tragic events along the way, but there was a big party, and there was a very big celebration. And there it says that David was dancing before all of the people of Israel, in dancing before the Aron. And let me take a look at the end of Pasuk Yud Bet. Anybody have it? Perek Vav?
Mm-hmm. Yud Bet?
Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayelech David vayal et Aron Elokim mibet oved Edom ir David besimcha. So David went to bring the Aron from its hiding place to ir David.
No, where are, what page are we on?
It's Perek, Shmuel Bet, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud, End of Yud Bet. Now we're going to Yud Dalet. V'David mecharker b'chol oz lifnei Hashem. David is dancing before the Aron. And then he's dancing with great energy. So if you take a look in Pasuk Chaf, skipping a little bit, Vayashav David levarechet beito, vateitze Michal bat Shaul likrat David. David goes home, and out comes Michal. Michal doesn't like what she saw. Well, he says, you dancing in such an irreverent manner. You're dancing around like an idiot. This is not appropriate for the king of Israel. Not appropriate. David says to Michal, I'm dancing before God who has chosen me over and above your father and your father's household to lead Israel. I'm not going to rejoice before God. I should despise myself. I should be low in his eyes. He pushes her off. He's not happy with her chastising of him. He throws it back on her face. And after this little marital spat, Pasuk of Gimel, Ula Michal bat Shaul lo ayala yaled ad yom mota. Michal, from that day forward, Chachal never had a child till the day she died. Meaning, in the pshat of the perek, David not only chastises her and pushes her away, he actually, at that point in time, decides to essentially abandon her role as his primary wife. Up until this point, she is the Eshet David, she is the heir to the throne, and at this point, no. And so they have no child. Now it's unclear what that means, that we have no child, whether that means that she's barren, or whether that means he just simply separates from her and refuses to have a child with her. It's unclear. But it is clear is that's sort of the prelude to the fact that David now needs to find who's going to be his primary wife to be able to have an heir to the throne. That's a whole different piece, which will eventually lead to the story of Bathsheba. But for now, right, this is a kind of a rejection of Michal. So Chazal pick up on the fact that Michal bat Shaul ayal yalid ad yom mota, that he had no, she had no child until the day she died, and kind of play on the phrase until the day she died, to suggest, and again it's in the Medrash, it's not in the Pshat, but it's an interesting observation, that ad yom mota lo ayal yalid aval biyom mota hayala, right? That he didn't have a child. She didn't have a child till the day she died, but the day she died, she had a child. And Chazal actually reframe it as she having died in childbirth, and list her amongst a series of women like Rachel who died in childbirth. Now, we have no evidence to a child to born to Michal. We have no evidence to any kind of lineage to Michal, except for Chazal coming back to this pasuk in our perek, perek gimel, pasuk hey. Vashishi Yitra'am le'egla eshet David, this sixth child being Yitra'am, born to Egla eshet David, Chazal say Egla eshet David is Michal. Why is she called Egla eshet David? Because she kind of brayed in childbirth as she died, like she kind of was kind of a scream, if you will, that ultimately was the end of her life as she gave birth. And that is the reference to Egla.
What does Egla mean?
Egla is a calf.
That's what I thought.
Right. Egla Zaha? Right. Egla Zaha, Egla. So, why did Chazal pick on this? Of all people in this list, why pick on this particular name to refer to Michal? The answer, I think, is simple. Of all of the six wives in this list, she's the only one who's referred to as Eshet David.
Interesting.
And if you look at the list, back in Perek Gimel,
going back to his correct first wife.
Right. If you look at the list, Achinoam Israelit, Avigail Eshet Navala Karmali, okay, that's a whole different story. Ma'acha bat Tamai Melech Geshur, Chagit, Shvet Avital, and Yitra'am, and Egla Eshet David. So there's only one in this list that's called Eshet David. We know of only one wife of David at this point in time who could have such a status as Eshet David, and that would be Michal. So that's where Chazal linked the two. If that's true, then this list for sure includes wives and sons who have not yet been born in Hebron.
So after Hebron, does he have several other marriages or no? As the king?
Well, yeah, because it's
is
unclear.
Just,
no, that's my point, is that this is not just Chevron. This can't be just Chevron, because Michal is certainly not dying when he's in Chevron. So Yitra'am Legla Eshet David is certainly not born in Chevron. Ma'acha bat Tamai Melech Geshur, if it's from the battle of Aram Sova in Perek Yud, hasn't even happened yet, and doesn't happen until Yerushalayim. So, in fact, what I'm suggesting is that this list is not a Hebron-based list. It's a list of his household as he starts in Hebron, but the actual list is a complete list of all of his wives up until and including Michal for the entire period of time. It doesn't include Bathsheba, but other than Bathsheba, it includes the full picture of David's wives and sons.
Wow.
It's not just Hebron. It goes all the way through, at least according to Chazal, it goes all the way through till Michal's death. And that is
so
a kind of a broad picture.
Why isn't Bathsheba included?
Because Bathsheba is a story unto itself. Bathsheba, you're not going to mention Bathsheba in the context in which Bathsheba makes no sense. Michal even is alluded to in a medrash. On the pshat of it, I could identify these as other people. Again, it's how Chazal saw this list. On the pshat of it, I would simply identify all these people as early, but. But certainly, as Chazal saw it, this is not just Chevron, but rather Asher Ela Yuldul David beChevron Nevaala, meaning the picture that starts in Chevron. It's a picture of the household of David in its complexity, in its entirety, in its foundation. It's part of against the backdrop of the failed house of Shaul and Ishbosheth, and how that side of the conflict is crumbling. We are presented with a picture at the beginning of Perek Yimel of the stability and the growth of the house of David. That's really what this five psukim are about. The contrast between the pasuk we just read, or the pasuk at the beginning of the parak, "V'atiyah milchama ruka ben Beit Shaul ben Beit David, v'David holech v'chazek, uveit Shaul holchim v'dalim." David's house continues to grow as Shaul's house continues to diminish. Case in point, David has six wives and children and heirs to the throne and stability and picture, etc. You'll do the David banim, bechevron plus, if you will. Right? He has a Bachor, he has a Asher Kilav, and he has Avshalom, and he has Adoniyahu, and he has Shvatya, and he has Yitzram, and he has wives, and he has... Okay. And then, Pasuk Vav, after that interlude, look at Pasuk Vav, he biyot ha-mechama ben Beit Shaul ben Beit David, ve'avner haya mitchazek be'Beit Shaul. As the war continued between the house of Shaul and the house of David, Avner grew in strength in the house of Shaul. We'll come to Avner in a moment. But you can see this kind of interlude between Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Vav. Pasuk Aleph, Vatir Mechama Ruka, Beit David Olech V'Chazek, Beit Shaul Olchim V'Dalim. David's house is growing, Shaul's house is diminishing. Pasuk Vav, as this war continued, Avner gained strength. We're going to go back to the story. And in between, Pesukim Batei, I kind of have this interlude of that has no place here, it seems, of the house of David. So what's the message? It's an expression of why. No, it's a demonstration of how David's household is establishing itself, is building. He's building a home, he's building heirs to the throne, he's establishing malchus, he's doing what a king should do, even as the opposition to him is crumbling and his stature and position is growing. So it's a simple message, but I think it conveys not just the Chevron piece of the story, but that's why I think it has a vision or a summary that goes beyond just Chevron.
By the way, mm-hmm. in Pasuk Vav, they have a whole thing about Agla.
Is that the
cow that they divvied up or whatever?
Yosef
David kol b'chor b'Yisrael shoshin
elav. What parak are you on?
Shmuel Bet.
What parak?
We'll start with Aleph.
What parak?
You're
way ahead.
I jumped ahead.
You're way ahead.
Oh, well, there's an Agla in there. Okay, sorry.
I don't know where you're going. Okay, back to Parak Gimel.
Oh, yeah, that is why.
Pasuk Vav. So today we're going to do the next little piece of the story, which is Pesukim Vav through Yud Aleph. Vayi biyot ha-milchama ben Beit Shaul uven Beit David, v'avner haya mitchazek be-Beit Shaul. As this war unfolds between the two houses and between the two armies, the focus here is now on Avner. Avner's position in the house of Shaul is growing. Why is it growing? Why is Avner getting stronger? What does that mean?
Are his other soldiers abandoning him?
Avner.
Maybe the Charles.
Don't get confused. Avner Ben Ner is the chief, is the general, the head of the army of
Shaul.
Ishbosheth. Shaul. Avner is the power behind the throne of Ishbosheth. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's not confusing.
So that's saying Ishbosheth is getting stronger.
You know, I'm going to do this again.
You said Avner.
It does not say Ishbosheth is getting stronger. It says Avner is getting stronger in the house of Shaul. This is not about Ishbosheth. This is about Avner. Mm. Okay? Avner, ayam mitchazek b'Beit Shaul. Why is Avner getting stronger? What does it mean?
Lots of men in the battle?
He did. Parak Bet was a setback for him. But as the war, there's a period of time between them, and he's the chief general, and he's a very shrewd and a very powerful general. Remember, he's the one who fights against the Plishtim and who liberates the land and who reestablishes, and he's the one who established Ishbosheth's reign and who crowned him as king and who carried him through and the entire land and all the different places, and built the crown and the kingdom of Ishbosheth. But Avner's position is one, he's the general, but he's also, simply put, the power behind the throne. Right? Avner is the power behind the throne. Ishbosheth's a nothing. Ishbosheth is a wimp. Ishbosheth doesn't have the strength to be in battle with his father in the battlefield. Ishbosheth never says anything. Ishbosheth never does anything. Avner takes Ishbosheth and makes him king, and Avner takes Ishbosheth and reigns him, crowns him over all the regions of Israel. Avner takes Ishbosheth and does the X, Y, and Z. And when Ishbosheth never said a word in this entire story. In fact, his name hasn't even been mentioned, right? In all of Perek Bet, I believe, on the story from the story of Givon is all about the forces of David and the forces of the house of Shaul. Ishbosheth's name is not even appear in the story. It's not about Ishbosheth and David, it's about Beit Shaul u'Beit David. Meaning it's about David and the household of Shaul. Who's the household of Shaul? Who's the household of Shaul?
Ishbosheth.
Ishbosheth is the king. Ishbosheth is Avner is the general, but Avner is not related. I mean, he's distantly related. He's a nephew, but certainly not the...
So Ishbosheth is like a figurehead.
Ishbosheth is a puppet. Ishbosheth is a puppet of Avner. And Avner calls the shots. And that's been the way it's been from day one. Quite frankly, it suits everybody. Without Avner, Ishbosheth would be
long gone.
A nobody or a nothing, right? Cast out into the fields and probably left to die. Without Avner, Ishbosheth would have been forgotten. Ishbosheth is not going to... Avner is not going to sit on the throne because he's not the son of Shaul. So Avner puts Ishbosheth on the throne and Avner calls the shots. It's a very simple arrangement. One that has been common to kings and princes and kingdoms for millennia. Simple arrangement. Avner ensures that Ishbosheth can sit on the throne, and Avner directs the kingdom.
He's in control.
Sure, the Haman to Achashverosh, but in a positive sense. So as this war continues to unfold, the general who's guiding this war is, of course, Avner. And Avner, Haya Mitchazek Bevet Shaul. Avner is growing in strength in the house of Shaul. Pasuk Zayin. Ulashaul Pilegesh. Ushmach Ritzba Bat Aya. Shaul. Melech Shaul, Zichrono Livracha, right? Shaul, the father, had a Pilegesh by the name of Ritzba Bat Aya.
What a name.
I know.
Well,
this could only be...
Only in modern Hebrew.
In
modern Hebrew.
Why, what's it in biblical Hebrew?
It's a name.
Ritzba's a floor.
I know.
Only in modern Hebrew. Ritzba Bat Aya. Vayomer el Avner. So he said to Avner, Madua bata el pilegashavi. Why have you slept with my father's pilegash? Ve'icha le'avner ma'od al divrei Ishbosheth. Avner was furious at Ishbosheth's words. Ve'yomer, he said to Ishbosheth, Harosh kelev anochi asher liyuda? What am I, a Judean dog? Ayom e'eseh chesed im Beit Shaul avicha el achav ve'el mere'eyu v'loim chiticha b'yad David. I did you the greatest favor possible to the house of Shaul, your father, to his brothers and his neighbors. I didn't hand you over to David. I could have walked up to David with your head and handed you over to him. I didn't. Instead, I put you on the throne. And today you're going to accuse me of and bring this iniquity upon my head? Thus shall God do for Avner. Ki kasher nishba Hashem le David, ki ken e'eselo. It's time for me to now fulfill God's words to David. La'avir ha'mamlacha mi'beit Shaul. To take the kingdom from the house of Shaul, ul'akim et kiseh David al Yisrael v'al Yehuda, midan v'ad Be'er. And to take David and to enable him to be king over all of Israel from Dan to Be'er on Yehuda and Yisrael. How dare you? He could not answer Avner. He was so afraid of him. Extraordinary story. But he will make good on his threat, Avner, and he will do exactly what he said he will do, and he will now go and change sides and take the entire kingdom of Israel and hand it over to David. So there's a lot to talk about in this little five psukim. First of all, an aside, we'll come back to the story of Ritzba Badaya and what the implications are.
I've never heard of any girl in Israel called Ritzba.
Okay, yeah, in modern Hebrew you wouldn't do that. But take a look at Pasuk Vav. Pasuk Zayin. Shaul Pilegesh Ushma Ritzba Badaya. Who's the subject of the sentence?
Shaul.
Correct? Mm-hmm. Shaul had a Pilegesh. Now, the name of Ritzba Badaya. She's a very powerful person. She's very righteous person. We'll come to her. She has a story later in Sefer Shmuel also. Her devotion to the family, her devotion to Yonatan and Mephibosheth. There's a really extraordinary stories about her later in the Sefer. But Shaul is a Pilegesh by the name of Ritzba Badai. Vayomer el Avner. He said to Avner, who said?
Ishbosheth. I'm backing into that because it's not defined yet.
You understand the problem?
Yeah.
Vayomer el Avner. He Shaul Pilegesh Ishma Ritzba Badai. Vayomer el Avner. Shaul had a Pilegesh. He said to Avner, who said? Shaul? Shaul is dead. Okay, so Shaul is not speaking. I mean, it's possible Shmuel spoke from the grave, but not likely, right? And it becomes clear, Madua Bata El Pilegesh Avi.
So it has to be Ishbosheth.
Because it's Boshet. So why doesn't it say Vayomer Ishbosheth?
Good question.
You're changing subjects. You can't change subjects without identifying who the new subject is. Vayomer. Sorry, Ulishaul Pilegesh, Vayomer Ishbosheth Lama Batal Pilegeshavi. What happened to the subject of the word Vayomer?
It just says El Avner.
Vayomer El Avner. He said to Avner, who's he?
We don't know yet.
Okay? I mean, there can only be one possibility, but it's a bit conspicuous that his name does not appear. So Avner's response and his reaction, Vayichal Avner Mo'od Al Divrei Ishbosheth. Clearly, the speaker there was Ishbosheth. Clearly, I mean that's not ambiguous. The irony is that the name is omitted from the text, but Avner gets very angry, and he says to him, Vayomer Arosh Kelav Anochel Yisrael Yehuda. What am I, some Judean dog, that you make such an accusation? Then he goes to a whole speech about how he's going to take the kingdom away from him and hand it over to David. Now skip to Pasuk Aleph. V'lo yachol od lehashiv et Avner davar meyuato oto. He could not respond to Avner because of his fear of him. Who could not respond?
Ishbosheth.
But it doesn't say his name.
It doesn't say. V'lo yachol Ishbosheth lehashiv et Avner. Up until now, Avner has been speaking. And suddenly it's V'lo yachol od lashivet Avner. In other words, in both psukim, the subject of the verbs are clearly Ishbosheth. But conspicuously, both psukim, Ishbosheth's name is missing.
Are we supposed to think Avner is going crazy and he's having a conversation with himself?
No, of course not.
Is this to minimize? Does it prove right. that just
But
Avner
if you erase
really
somebody's
good.
Name... There's a message there. Right. Remember, Ishbosheth's whole personality is one of weakness. He's nothing. What are we describing? We're describing a person who can't even respond to Avner. He has no words left. He can't even respond. He's too frightened to even comment. The fact that the only place where we hear Ishbosheth say anything. Ishbosheth has not had a speaking part. You know the famous joke? Right, you know the famous joke about the kid who comes home from... Oh, I won't say it. It's recording. That would not be nice.
You can turn that off.
But, Ishbosheth has been king since the beginning of... since the middle of Perek Bet. He has not said a single word. There is no sentence or speech attached to Ishbosheth in the entire story, save one sentence.
This one.
The one sentence he accuses Avner of taking his father's Pilegesh, and his name is omitted from that pasuk. I mean, come on. Vayomer right? Blank el Avner lama batal Pilegesh avi. What's the impression? Ishbosheth is
nervous.
Erased. Nothing. Zero. The status, the stature, nothing Ishbosheth can do on his own. Everything he has from Avner, his stature, his position, his king, his crown, comes from Avner. Avner put him on the throne, and Avner can just as easily
remove
it. And that's exactly what Avner says to him. How dare you open your mouth to me? I put you here? I can take it away. That's precisely what he says to him. What am I, some kind of Judean dog? Look at the kindness I did to the house of Shaul. I put you on your throne. I didn't hand you over to David. Okay, I put you on the throne. You know what else I can do? I can take the throne away. The same way God promised the throne to David, I will make sure that it happens. I'll take the throne from the house of Shaul and I'll hand it to David. Not a problem. How dare you?
He's the ultimate pawn. He's only there.
Ishbosheth is a pawn, but Ishbosheth is a necessary pawn, meaning to a large extent, it's very convenient. Ishbosheth would never have been able to achieve the throne without Avner. Avner would never be able to achieve power without an heir to the throne. So it's a marriage of convenience between Avner and Ishbosheth. Avner is the power, and Ishbosheth gets to wear the crown, as long as Ishbosheth learns his place. And his place is to keep his mouth shut and let Avner run the show.
Yeah.
100%.
But also in terms of the story, it moves the plot along. Now you know why Avner switched sides.
Well, we need to this information. This is the reason why So let's talk a little bit about this Pilegesh by the name of Ritzpah Bat Aya. What does Ishbosheth accuse Avner of? And what is Avner's response? So there's a little bit of background you need to have to understand what's going on. Let's just take one of these and pass them down. For us, this is a foreign world. For us, this is a very foreign world. But we need to put ourselves back into the frame of reference of the world of Tanakh. One of my big peeves in life is when we judge biblical stories on the basis of modern sensibilities. Can't do that. It's not fair to the biblical story. It's not fair to the personalities of Tanakh. They operated within the context of the rules and standards and expectations of the generation of the time. And one of those concepts is the role and the status of a Pilegesh. Now, Pilegesh a little bit has a bit of a bad rap in modern life, but Pilegesh essentially, in a world of polygamy, more or less, a person had a primary wife whose primary role was to be the establishment of the household and to have children, And the Pilegesh is essentially a wife whose connection was not one to build a house and to have children, but just to be a wife. More or less, that's the role of a Pilegesh. Right? A wife for, you know, in a polygamous context, that's what you had, right? You had more than one wife, but you always had one primary wife, and then the other was to essentially to have a marital relationship, but not necessarily to have a family. In the context of kings, the role of Pilegesh takes on a different character. So in the context of kings, the Pilegesh had a larger stature. It was very common for kings to have multiple wives and multiple concubines of Pilegshim, Pilegshot. And Shlomo Melech took that status to an extreme, far greater than he should have. But it was not an uncommon phenomenon. Now, there is a halacha, and this is based on a sort of the principles of Malchus, or the etiquette of Malchus, that out of covet to a king, and this I'll show you in the Gemara, I didn't quote the Gemara because the Gemara gets complicated. I quoted the Rambam's summary of the halacha in the Gemara. Okay. So the second paragraph is the Rambam's halacha in Huchas Malachim. Kavod gadol nagim lemelech. You have to give great deference and respect to the king. Umasimim lo ema v'yira b'cholev b'lev kol adam. And every person has to have a sense of fear and reverence for the king. Sh'ne'emar som tasim alecha melech. You shall appoint a king, and the Gemara understands the word som tasim as shetehe emato alecha. He has to have a kind of a sense of reverence. A king needs to tower over the people. There has to be a sense of respect and reverence for the king. King can't be a pal. This is a status of covenant malchus. And therefore, ein rochvin al suso, person is not allowed to ride the king's horse. Ve'en yoshvin al kiso, not allowed to sit on the king's throne. Ve'en mishtamshim b'sharvito, nor can you use the king's scepter. V'lo bekitro, nor his crown. V'lo bechad mikol klei tashmishav, nor any of his clothes. All of these things belong to the king, and they can't be used, not during the king's, they can't be used during his lifetime, nor can they be used after the king's death. When he dies, they're all burnt. In other words, you can't take the royal clothes of the king and hand them to his son. Like, this is a Jewish king. Right? This is the laws of kingship within Israel. What happens outside, we don't know, but in the world of the kings of Israel, there's a certain reverence it has to have for the king, and when the king dies, his crown, his scepter, his clothes, they don't go to his son. They don't go to the next in line. They get buried with the king. That's the way it's supposed to be. And now we come to the key piece. V'chein lo yishtamesh ba'avadav v'shivchotav v'shamashav. Similarly, an ordinary person can't go and buy the king's slaves or borrow the king's servants or use the king's maidservants or any of his shamashim, servants, ela melech acher. The only one who's allowed to is another king. Now, this is all a very big euphemism. Why? Because the reference here to avadav, shivchatav, shamashav is in fact a reference, but it's a euphemism, to the king's wives and pilegeshes. In other words, what happens to the king's widow? Or, in the case of a Pilegesh, to the Pilegesh of the king. They can never remarry an ordinary, a commoner. Because that would be a violation of the integrity of the Malchus. And so out of respect to the Malchus, they are, in a sense, inherited, lefichach, they are, in a sense, inherited by the next king. The next king is allowed to use the king's servants, etc., and he's allowed to inherit, if you will, the king's pilegesh. It's a bit of an odd context, but that's the halach. So, and the way the Gemara formulates it is that a pilegesh of a king is not allowed to marry a hedjot, can only marry another king. So Pilegesh had a particularly unique status in Tanakh. Now, why is that relevant? Because that one piece of information is the key to understanding about four different biblical stories. So what am I referring to? And what am I referring?
I don't know. The one that jumps out is Pilegesh Bagiva, but I don't really see the connection.
No, not Pilegesh Bagiva. That's actually the one Pilegesh story that doesn't apply. Okay. The
what about the whole Pilegesh? We're going to get hang on a second.
No, so we're going to get there. Hang on a second. So the piece that it explains is the fact that part of the, you know what? Rather than just saying it, let me show you. I'm going to show you. I'll show you a couple of stories, and you'll see exactly what's going on. Turn. We're going to jump forward in time for a little bit to Perek Tet Zayin. Mered Avshalom. Everybody know what the story of the rebellion of Avshalom is about? Many, many years later, David is faced with the crisis of his life when his son Avshalom rebels against him and essentially tries to throw David off the throne and usurp the throne from underneath him. Are you familiar with that story? Does it sound familiar at all?
Yes.
Avshalom forces David into exile. David has to run away. Avshalom takes over Yerushalayim, and then eventually David's forces come back and Avshalom has to run. But right, there's a great rebellion that develops in the house of David. It's a reaction to the murder of Avshalom. Amnon, and the story of Amnon and Tamar, which is in aftermath of the story of Bathsheba, but there's a whole bunch of connections. So Perek Tet Zayin is the rebellion of Avshalom. Pasuk Tet Vav. We're going to skip around a little bit. But David is forced into exile from Yerushalayim. And Pasuk Tet Vav, Avshalom b'chol ha'am ish Yisrael bau Yerushalayim v'achitofel ito. Avshalom, together with Achitofel, come to Yerushalayim. Essentially, Avshalom takes over the palace. Avshalom has, for a short period of time, usurped the kingdom from David.
His dad.
His father, correct. Skip the next part of this paragraph. Pasuk Chaf. Vayomer Avshalom el Achitofel. Havu lachem etza. Ma nase? Turns to Achitofel, and he says, tell me, Achitofel, I need something to solidify this hold on this kingdom. I need something to demonstrate that I'm now the king. Fair? Vayomer Achitofel el Avshalom, bo el pilagshe avicha asher iniach lishmor habayit v'shama ko Yisrael ki nivashta et avicha v'chazku yedei kol asher itach. Go and sleep with your father's pilagishes. Go and take them and demonstrate that you have taken over your father's pilegishes. Meaning, in the language of Tanakh, this is a way you demonstrate that you have taken the power of the throne, you have inherited, you have taken your father's pilegish. The pilegish becomes a symbol for the power of the throne. Again, we can judge it, we can look at it in modern context, it certainly would, there's a lot to be said about it, but in the context of Tanakh, this was the rules and the etiquette. Now, in Avshalom's case, he does something which I don't think Achitofel actually meant, but nonetheless he does anyway. V'yatula Avshalom ha'oel al hagag v'yavo Avshalom el pilagshe aviv le'enei ko Yisrael. I think Achitofel meant to do it in private. Avshalom decides to do it in public, places a tent on the rooftop of the house, of the palace, and demonstrates to all of Israel that he's now in control of of his father's pilagish. The Pilegesh becomes a symbol for the revolt, for the rebellion, for the power. I'm now king. I'm entitled to the pilegish of the king. Not an uncommon phenomenon in the world of Tanakh to perceive power struggles between leaders and generations through the eyes of the status of the pilegish. At least according to one line of thought amongst the Rishonim, Balei HaTosfot, by the name of the Rivash, Rav Yosef B'Chor Shor, that was exactly the motivation behind Reuven's act with Bilhah. Vayelech Reuven vayishkav et Bilhah pilegesh aviv. When Reuven went and took pilegesh Bilhah, his father's pilegesh, Rashi reinterprets it and sanitizes it a little bit, says to Rashi, no, it's exactly what it says. He took his father's pilegesh. Why? Because his father was no longer able to lead in the aftermath of Shechem, in the aftermath of Dinah, in the aftermath of everything else. They felt that his father had lost control and lost power. Somebody needed to usurp the throne. Somebody needed to step up. Reuven decided to step up. And so he does so by taking his father's pilegesh. The foundation, the piece of the story is the same. The pilegesh becomes a symbol for the power, the authority of the throne. There's another story at the beginning of Malachim Aleph, where at the end of beginning of Malachim Aleph, David HaMelech is on his deathbed. They bring him Avishag to warm him up. This is a very strange story, but in the context of that story, and David doesn't want to have any connection to Avishag. He doesn't see her as a pilegesh. Everybody else saw her as a pilegesh. David did not. It's a whole story. But after he dies, Adonio makes a simple request from Bathsheba to Shlomo, and he makes the request. Adonio says, "You know, I have just one request. Do you mind if I marry Avishag?" And Bathsheba says, "I don't see anything wrong with that." Comes to Shlomo and says, "Adonio has made a request. He wants to marry Avishag, Ashunamit." And Shlomo says, "Off with his head. Treason. Execute him." Made a request to marry Avishag. Why is that treason?
Because he wants to take control.
Because Avishag was Pilegesh, his father. In other words, the role of the Pilegesh is a symbol of the power of the throne. It's, and that's common to the world of Tanakh. The moment Avner takes Mitzvah Bat Ayah, his father, of Shaul's Pilegesh, what is he saying?
I'm in control.
Then I'm the power of the throne. Take a look at the Malbim. Ule Shaul Pilegesh. Shemin Adin, Pilegesh HaMelech Asura LeHedyot. According to the law, Pilegesh of the king is not allowed to marry a commoner. Ki ein mishtamshim b'sharvito shel melech mitam kvod HaMelech. You're not allowed to use the king's kalim out of cover to the king. The Avner, now, lo chash l'zeh. Avner didn't care. Uva el pilegesh ha-melech. And he took a mitzvah bataya, the king's pilegesh. Ki ilu gam elav yautu inyanei ha-malchut. B'yot hu ha-mish'enet el ha-malchut. As if to say, he's entitled. He's the power of the throne. He's entitled. In other words, says the Malbim, and this is very important for us, Ishbosheth accuses Avner of having taken Mitzvah Bat Ayah. He doesn't accuse Avner falsely. He's not making a false accusation. Oh, there's a rumor, Avner, that you're having an affair with Mitzvah Bat Ayah. That's not the issue. This is not sordid affairs. This is public status, public power. Avner, in fact, says the Malbim, and I think it's Pshat in the Perek, had taken Mitzvah Bat Ayah to him as his wife, or as his pilegesh. That is a fact. That is not in question. The implication, however, for Ishbosheth was, you, Avner, are not the heir to the throne. You are not the king. I am. and you don't have the right to take Yitzba Bataya, my father's Pilegesh. This is a fight about status. Avner, Holecho Mitchazek, who's getting stronger, and Ishbosha turns to him and he says, by what right do you, the general, commoner, not the heir to the throne, have to marry the king's Pilegesh? Follow? It's not about false accusations. It's about the interpretation of his actions. He does, in fact, take Ritzba Bataya, and Ishbosheth, in the only sentence Ishbosheth ever utters in the entire story, says to him, that's treason. You are not the king. And against that backdrop, now reread Avner's response. Pasuk Chet. Vayicha le'Avner me'od al divrei Ishbosheth. Avner is furious at Ishbosheth's words. Everybody see where I'm reading? Vayomer, he says to him, Harosh kelev anochi ashel Yehuda? What do you think I am? Some commoner? Some dog? Some head of a dog of a Judean off the Judean streets? A nobody? That you accuse me of treason by taking the king's Pilegesh? I put you on the throne. Hayom eseh chesed in Beit Sheol Avicha el Achav ve'el Mere'eyu ve'lo emtziticha biyad David. I put you on the throne. I didn't hand you over to David. I could have taken you and handed you to David. You would have handed your head to David. Last heir to the throne of Shaul, when David became king. I spared your life. I put you on the throne. I'm the power to the throne. How dare you speak to me like that? Vatifkod alei avona Yishayom? That you're going to claim that I committed a transgression of the Pilegesh? I'm no less entitled to the Pilegesh than you are. And a 100 times more so. Because
you have to maintain the kingship.
You're only on the king because of, on the throne because of me. This is a very mutually beneficial relationship. You sit on the throne and I establish and I defend your kingdom. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be on the throne. And if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be able to build the kingdom. So, you do what I say. I'm the power. I can take the king's Pilegesh. And everybody knows that I'm the power behind the throne. I don't think he did it in secret. Right? I don't think he married Ritzva Bataya in secret. I think he did it in public because
everybody knew that
he wanted to demonstrate that he's the power behind the throne. Like, this Ishbosheth is very nice. You bow to him and then you do exactly what I tell you to do. Because Ishbosheth is very nice. How does this whole paragraph begin? Look at Pasuk Vav again. This paragraph is about Avner's power in the house of Shaul growing. And part of that power was his claim to the authority of the king and the right, therefore, to marry the Pilegesh of the king as a way to demonstrate that Ishbosheth is my puppet. I'm the puppeteer.
Isn't it still wrong? I mean, he's not the king.
Well, intents and purposes, he is the king. It's just not the... doesn't wear the crown, but...
It's kind of like he's overthrowing...
It's out of covet to the king. Okay, so covet to the king. So who's the real king? Who's the real power behind the throne? Ishbosheth. Avner.
No, Avner.
Ishbosheth
is the puppet.
Right? I understand Avner. I understand where he's coming from. No greater way to solidify Avner's control in the kingdom. How dare he? This little
whippersnapper.
Nothing. He's a nothing.
But all of a sudden, Ishbosheth wakes up. All of a sudden, Ishbosheth wakes up.
All of a sudden, Ishbosheth has a sentence.
Yeah.
Half a sentence without his name.
I'm saying that's still
wakes up is a bit gives him too much credit.
But you hear nothing, and then all of a
Correct.
Sudden he.
And you'll hear nothing from him again, because at the end of this paragraph, he has nothing left to say. Right. Well, I'm going to come back to Ishbosheth in a second. Okay, you don't want to let me be the power to the throne? Not a problem. I'm happy to hand the throne back to David. After all, that's what God promised David in the first place. As God promised the kingdom to David, I will make it so. I will bring the kingdom. I'm always the power behind the throne. I'm always the power behind the throne. I'll be the power behind your throne, but if you don't like it, that's okay. I'll become the power behind David's throne. I will take the kingdom from the house of Shaul, and I will build David's kingdom over the house combined of Yisrael and Judah. You don't like it? Not a problem. I put you on the throne, I'll put David on the throne. I built your kingdom, I can just as well build David's.
But Ish-bosheth says nothing.
He can't. He is so frightened. He is so put in his place. He doesn't know what to how to swallow Avner. His words. He's totally, literally silenced in his tracks. So that's the background to this moment. And we'll see what Avner will make good on his threat. And Avner will go to David momentarily. But a couple of additional pieces of information that I think we need to, or observations we need to recognize. Number one, why does Ish-bosheth open his mouth now? What does Ish-bosheth gain from this? I mean, he obviously doesn't gain anything. He loses the store, right? He loses everything. But what is in his own mind? Why does Ish-bosheth think that he's going to? What does Ish-bosheth think he's going to gain now? By opening up his mouth against Avner. Now suddenly the story of Yitzhak Padaya. I don't even know if Yitzhak Padaya is new information, right? This may have even happened a while back. Why now attempt to kind of push Avner out? His accusation about Yitzhak Padaya isn't about, maybe it's not so nice, pasnished. Right? Ish-bosheth isn't saying to Avner, this isn't appropriate, it's pasnished, why don't you get rid of her? What is Ish-bosheth saying to Avner when he says to her, how dare you take my father's pilegish?
That the kingship's going to go through him and not through Ish-bosheth.
What it's really saying is, I'll fire you. Right? This is treason. Goodbye, Avner.
Right.
After everything Avner did to put him on the throne, it's basically saying to Avner, you're done. This kind of accusation can bring down a very powerful person. So how on earth did Ish-bosheth think for a moment that at this point in time he's going to, as Holecho Mitchazek, Shaul, house of Avner is growing in strength, he's going to bring down Avner with such an accusation? And why now? So it could be that he's just an idiot. Right? That is entirely possible because, I mean, clearly he loses everything. It's also possible that there's a trigger here. What's the trigger?
The first sentence where it says, "Vayhi milchama ben Beit Shaul ben."
Avner's growing in strength, maybe.
Right,
maybe Avner's growing in strength, growing too strong for Ish-bosheth's own comfort zone, possibly. We're in the world of conjecture because we don't know. It doesn't tell us. But the other possibility is go back to Perek Bet. Avner has done something in Perek Bet that is very dangerous. What did Avner do in Perek Bet that's so dangerous? Now, this battle should have been over eons ago. Why is this battle not over? What did Avner do back in Perek Bet that made Avner such a reviled personality in the house of David? Why did the war not end in Perek Bet? Why did the war continue? Talk about this?
This whole thing about...
Really, the war should have ended. Avner is virtually surrounded, virtually... defeated 360 people. for all intents and purposes, the war should have ended. Yoav declared a truce. Yoav blew the shofar. Yoav retreated back to his house. Yoav went back to Hebron. Yoav agreed that this is brother against brother and we shouldn't be fighting. Right? That's how the parak ended. So why does the continue? Why does the story continue? Why does the battle continue? Did we talk about the end, the last psukim of parak bet? After Avner makes a stand, and Yoav retreats, and Yoav blows the shofar, and Yoav goes home. Then it says, Vati Mechama Aruka. Between the two houses, a great long battle. They just declared a truce. He just retreated. He just blew the shofar, and he said, call off the war. Three psukim later, the war is long and protracted and drawn out. Why?
Was the ill pursuit of Avner going, it turned out.
I'm reading the end of the parak. End of parak bet. They're all retreating. They're all going home. Itka pasuch avchad v'itka Yoav shofar v'yamdu kol ha'am v'lo yedifu od acharei Yisrael. Yoav blew a shofar. They all went home. They no longer fought. The war's done. Then they take a census.
Was it because of Hazael?
And they discovered that Avner had killed Asael. The war was over. There was a truce declared. There was a treaty signed. But a treaty on false pretense. Because when that treaty was signed, Avner forgot to tell Yoav that he had killed his brother.
Oh, wow. Very convenient.
Yoav doesn't discover that Avner killed Asael until the end of the parak. They took a census and discovered 19 people were killed and Asael. This was a treason, a treaty signed on false pretense. You came to me and you said, why should we kill brother against brother? Let's call off the war. You forgot to tell me you killed my brother. How dare you? The battle should have been over, except that Avner made a terrible mistake. He killed Asael. Knowing full well, he did it in self-defense, but knowing full well that Yoav will never sleep at night until he avenges Asael's blood. And that's exactly what will happen in Perek Gimel. In the aftermath of Perek Bet, Ishbosheth's discomfort comes from the fact, maybe, that Avner has made himself a marked man. This has now become a personal war of vengeance against Avner for killing Asael. So to some extent it serves Ishbosheth's interests to distance himself from Avner. Avner, maybe I can do better without you. You're a marked man. Asael, Yoav's not going to sleep well at night until he kills you. Well, you know what? You're a marked man. Anybody in your circle is also a marked man. I don't want to be a marked man. I don't want to be killed. Maybe you should go your own way. And he finds himself the opportunity in the story of Ritzvah Badaya. And Avner looks at him and he says, how dare you? I'm a marked man? My blood is going to spill? You worried about me? Maybe you should worry about yourself. Maybe you should worry about yourself. Without me, you're a nobody. I put you on the throne, I'll take you off the throne. And guess what? The throne doesn't go to David until Ishbosheth is killed in his sleep. Because without Avner, Ishbosheth doesn't last 5 minutes. I'm a marked man. Rosh Kelev Anochi Asher LeYehuda. So I think the battleground between Avner and Ishbosheth is built on the backdrop of the story of Avner killing Asael. That piece of the story comes constantly comes back to the center. Yoav eventually kills Avner in vengeance for the blood of Asael.
The rest of this period. He was a marked man.
Maybe. Maybe. Ishbosheth doesn't last very long either without him, but maybe. But that is the that I think is part of the background. One more piece of the Avner tragedy, which is Pasuk Yud.
In Bet?
In Gimel. A piece of information we learned here that we never knew before. But it's really very, very striking. La'avira mamlacha mi-Beit Sha'ul. Sorry, Pasuk Tet. My apologies. Pasuk Tet. Ko yaseh alakim la'avne v'cho yasif lo, ki kasher nishba Hashem le-David, ki ken eseh lo la'avira mamlacha mi-Beit Sha'ul la'akim et kiseh David al-Yisrael v'al-Yehuda midan v'arbeh shava. It's time for me to fulfill God's promise to David, and to bring him the kingdom from Dan to Beersheba, from all of Israel and all of Judah together. The reference to Kasher Nishba Hashem le David is the first time we hear that Avner is aware that God promised the kingdom to David. Remember, that's between Shmuel and David. So we keep conjecturing and guessing that how much do the people know, how much do they not know, who knows, who doesn't know, right? Was he was anointed king? We have no way of knowing. But at least from Avner's perspective, Avner, who was the general of Shaul, who was in that inner circle, for the first time we now know that Avner knew all along that David had been given a nevuah and a promise from God that he would sit on the throne. What does that tell us about Avner? It's not positive.
Well, he thinks he's greater than Hashem.
Right. Remember that when David sat on the throne, Avner made a choice. Avner took Ishbosheth, took him out to Machanaim, and crowned him king. We could have said, okay, he doesn't know any better. Nobody knew that David was promised the kingdom by God. David was the rebel. David was the one, the insubordinate. David was the treasonous one. Ishbosheth is the heir to the throne. But now, for the first time, we learn that Ishbosheth knew, that Avner knew all along that there had been this promise to David. And that Ratzon Hashem, God's message through the Navi, was that David was the rightful heir to the throne, and yet Avner took Ishbosheth and crowned him king and fought the wars and established his position, etc., etc. That's a bit of a game changer, because it puts Avner in a somewhat different light. So it's subtle, but I think it's very very powerful. So in the end of the day, we're going to stop here. At the end of this parak, we have two personalities about whom we have learned a great deal of a great deal today: Ishbosheth and Avner. Neither one comes out particularly rosy pink, right? Exactly. So we will Bezrat Hashem pick up on what happens when Avner changes, crosses the aisle, as they call it in the world of politics, and comes over to the House of David, and how long that lasts.